Hello, you're listening to the 2015 National Radio Homelessness Marathon. From CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Treaty 6 Territory, I'm Rylan Kafara. I work, volunteer, and hang out with friends in inner city Edmonton. I also teach a free class on the history of punk, which is also a radio show here on CJSR.
And I'm Daniel Johnson. I'm a researcher and writer, and I teach courses on community engagement at the University of Alberta. I also work at the Women's Emergency Accommodation Center, which is a 66-bed homeless shelter for women in Edmonton's inner city. In this hour of the Homelessness Marathon...
It's called voting. We've been voting the same goddamn prime minister in for forever. Get rid of him.
Indigenous people are disproportionately represented in many negative statistics in Alberta and across Canada. Homelessness, the criminal justice system, prisons, the child welfare system. Indigenous women are often among the most vulnerable and most marginalized. Later this hour, we hear from Indigenous women and other women in Edmonton's inner city as they talk about their experiences of displacement, what they think about the government, and how they build communities of support and resistance.
To me, it's of interest that the whole model is premised on potentially displacement. So, you know, even if discussions are had, how meaningful are they? I don't know. But when the entire model is predicated on increasing property values, you know, that raises some questions I think critics have been asking, and I'm not sure they've been satisfied with the answers they've received. There has been a community benefits agreement that was signed. It's obviously far too early to evaluate it, and I hope, you know, someday people will. In terms of the stated commitments that are made and what happens to communities who are, in Edmonton's case, very vulnerable, you know, as you know, in the area. And whether or not there's been enough public discussion, I think, is a very important question. But, you know, the whole point has been, in my opinion, in part, to ship people out.
Edmonton's downtown is rapidly changing. New office buildings, hotels, a new provincial museum, and a sparkling new arena for the Edmonton Oilers. These are all causes of concern for people in the inner city. Is this downtown revitalization, or just another event in a long series of displacements? When Indigenous people and people that are homeless are often banned from public places, how does downtown gentrification impact public space? That's first up in this hour of the National Radio Homelessness Marathon.
The most recent homeless count took place in Edmonton on October 15, 2014. This one-day survey counted 2,307 people who are experiencing homelessness in the city. Though this is an overall increase since the 2012 count, many frontline workers still believe this number is low. Edmonton is experiencing rapid population growth, a rental vacancy rate that is below 2%, and rents that continue to rise. An individual on social assistance through Alberta Works receives $323 per month for housing allowance. It is increasingly difficult to find safe and affordable housing, especially for those who are most marginalized.
At the same time, Edmonton's downtown is undergoing rapid transformation. The inner city is where you'll find most supportive services and community centers for people who are homeless and economically marginalized. Fueled by a $600 million downtown sports and entertainment district that City Council is helping to fund, many are wondering what will happen to inner-city community members when this development is finished. Revitalization, that is, gentrification, in Edmonton is raising questions about who can access and use public space.
We asked Associate Professor Jay Scher from the Faculty of Physical Education and Recreation for some background on the downtown arena deal set for inner city Edmonton.
Well, in Edmonton, the city has entered essentially into an agreement with the Cates Group. And the Cates Group, for those listeners who aren't from Edmonton, own the Edmonton Oilers. And the agreement is, well, it's very complex, but I'll reduce it to the most important number, and that is... the city is going to debt finance over $600 million arena and entertainment district in downtown Edmonton. It was a decision that was made for two reasons, at least at the city's level. The first was to provide, security that the Oilers would remain in Edmonton for over three decades. And the second narrative that really featured was the idea that the city needed to have this type of arena entertainment district to, you know, revitalize the downtown core, which is an issue that's been on the agenda for civic elites for many years now. So huge investment, huge amount of public funds, not uncontroversial, as you know, and for those listening, it was one of the biggest political debates we've had in the city over the course of many years.
So why was there this effort to revitalize the area?
Well, you know, it's the usual type of discourse. If an area is understood to be derelict or downtrodden, which in the case of Edmonton's downtown core certainly is the perception of many within the city and many in City Hall, and coupled with the belief that any type of city that aspires to have this identity as you know, as a world-class city needs to have the type of, you know, these types of cultural amenities like entertainment districts and new arenas. So those were two of the main driving factors. But when you have areas that, you know, like Edmonton downtown, they also are very appealing in one sense because their property values are low. And you can make a lot of money if you buy low, as you know. And so sort of all these complex factors are coming into play right now, and that's the decision that the city's made is to pursue that type of investment. You know, the whole idea of world class is an interesting one in itself, right? I mean, what does it mean? I mean, to me, it's just this vacuous kind of signifier that any city aspiring to be world class is essentially saying, well, we're not. And perhaps never will be. But the whole meaning of the term is just something for claimants to try and aspire to. So yeah, I mean, there's been lots of cities that have pursued these types of strategies. And in fact, that's what makes Edmonton so boring in many ways. It's just duplicating what so many others have done before. But you know, the significance for me, as well as is that issue, is just the sheer amount of public funds that are now being dedicated to this idea of world class and this specific facility.
You're listening to the 2015 Homelessness Marathon here on CJSR in Edmonton, 88.5 FM. The National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty issued a report on the criminalization of homelessness in U.S. cities last summer. The report showed the increase in laws targeting those who are homeless and economically marginalized in the United States. For example, of 187 U.S. cities surveyed, 53% have a ban on lying down and sitting in particular public places. 43% of U.S. cities surveyed have a citywide ban on sleeping in cars. The report also notes that in no U.S. state can someone making minimum wage afford a one-bedroom apartment at a fair market rent.
So not only is it increasingly difficult for those living at or below the economic poverty line to afford safe and secure housing, jurisdictions in the U.S. and Canada continue to over-police public spaces, thereby criminalizing people who are homeless and economically marginalized. The Ontario Safe Streets Act and the broken windows theory of policing, which is employed by the Edmonton Police Service, target people who are using public spaces for things like sitting, sleeping, socializing, smoking, and drinking.
The gentrification of downtown Edmonton is drastically reducing the amount of public space. Parking lots, the Greyhound Station, and other public spaces will become privately owned public spaces, no doubt policed not only by the city, but also private security firms. City Council rezoned a street in downtown Edmonton so that billionaire Daryl Cates, owner of the Edmonton Oilers, could purchase it as part of the arena development.
You know that public space and the freedom to use it are both under attack when a private businessman buys a street. Gary Moustous comes from the Sturgeon Lake Cree Nation in Alberta. He works in the inner city of Edmonton as a cultural support worker at an inner city nonprofit agency. We spoke to Gary about the effect of downtown gentrification on the community that he serves.
Well, I think the impact could both be positive and negative. If it's done properly, I think that our inner city community would benefit a lot from the development that's happening. Up until now, I don't really see anything or anything that's to their benefit. I see the buildings coming up higher and higher, and our people in the inner city are being left out. Yes, the downtown core, the businesses and that are going to benefit, and the spinoff of all the dollars that are going to be generated from the attraction of the arena in particular, and all the other downtown core buildings that are coming up, all the dollars that are going to be attracted by those businesses, and the businesses that are going to benefit a lot. And it seems like the missing piece is what about the people that occupied this area for so long? And then, you know, people talk about being displaced. These people are being displaced in their own territory. It's like in society, it's like the Aboriginal people being displaced and being put into this one little area. And this is your reserve. This is where you exist, and this is where you stay. We will fund you. We will, you know, give you what you need, but stay within that border. And it seems like that is happening within the city as well, where, okay, we don't want to see homeless people in the downtown core area. So this is a place where you exist. We'll ban you from all these other places, so this is where you exist. So that, I see, is happening. They're being centered in just one area. And the places that they've been displaced from, it's their territory. It's the territories that are being developed are places where they picked bottles and, you know, survived in those areas and all that other stuff, and now we have to coexist in some other area and being displaced. It's not like us, the people that have homes and the people that have jobs and that. It's not as easy as us moving to a different city or going to the south side to move into a neighborhood. It's not as easy as that. Our people in the inner city, they exist in one area. And it's territorial, especially with gangs being involved in all of that. They cannot exist in another area. It's not like they can easily move to the West End and be accepted there by the neighborhood, by all the other people. It's not like that they can even cross over from 105th Street to come over to, or to go over to 107th. It's very territorial, and people don't realize the dangers that are involved by people being displaced from one area to another. And there's so much that is there that needs to be looked at. And with the businesses and the buildings that are coming up, they, you know, there's a lot of potential there for our community members to in the downtown core to be able to benefit from those as well. And one of the things is that I've voiced out is having an agency, one of the nonprofit agencies, take over the temp work that is constantly contracted out to people who benefit and who take up to sometimes up to 60% of the earnings that these people work very hard for, and let alone all the hard hats and steel-toed boots that they rent out to them, and also the bus tickets that they give. By the time they get the money that they work for at the end of the day, it's only like 40% of what they work for. So my dream is to have an inner-city nonprofit agency get those contracts and give that work to the people and have them earn their money, they earn and worked hard for, and give 100% of what they earn to them, not 40%, not 60%. There's a lot of potential there for a lot of work for our inner city people, but it's not being they're not being utilized I see sometimes a truck pull up to where all the inner city people gather. A truck pulls up and all they need to say, anyone want to work? You should see the amount of people that just jump up and, you know, are ready and willing to go to work. But most of the people can't either because there's ID issues. There's, you need a social insurance number. You need this, you need that. By the time, you know, you get these people to a place where they're comfortable, they're very discouraged because they don't really have the means to be able to meet the criteria of some of the temporary agencies that are in the city already.
Do you see any potential for the community members that you work with to enjoy any of the entertainment or sports aspect of the development?
I don't think so. I don't think that they have any desire or any that they will participate in any of the enjoyment of what is coming up there. I think it's only an elite group of people that are going to be enjoying the. They can't afford. They can't afford a ticket to go see a hockey game. They can't even afford to probably buy a drink there. A drink of. A fountain pop or whatever. It's like I said, it's a very elite group that will be accessing those venues. I'm not even interested. I don't think I'd ever even step foot in that building. In that arena, because I have no desire. I have no desire for sports or anything, you know, to watch a hockey game or all of that. So one of the things that I find that's happening now, which should have happened like years and years ago, is that there are roundtables happening, but it's after the fact. There's roundtables and asking the homeless communities what input they have to end poverty and what input they have to end homelessness. That should have been done in the get-go when they determined that they were going to stop homelessness within 10 years. Well, now it's just about going down to the final years here, and I don't think they've made an impact on ending homelessness. Well, ask the professionals, ask the experts as to what homelessness is and how to combat and how to end poverty, how to end homelessness. And that's these roundtables that are happening now. I sat in a couple of roundtables, and the information and the ideas that the people came with are stuff that can be used.
At the Women's Emergency Accommodation Center in downtown Edmonton, where I work, I spoke with Jojo, who is a resident there. Sitting in an office looking out the window at 96th Street and the high-end hotel that is being built across the street from the shelter, I asked her what she thought the effect of the hotel would be on the community. So we're looking out the window here at a fancy hotel that's getting built next to the shelter. How do you think these will exist as neighbors?
I think they're going to... I'm scared that they're going to ask us to leave. They're going to ask us to leave. They're going to turn this place into some fancy museum or something. They're going to spruce this little thing up, or else spruce this building up to make it look like another 5-star hotel or something, and ask us to leave.
Where do you think people would go?
Where we'd go,
yeah,
where the shelter would go, they'd ask us to move further down, someplace further down, away from this big fancy hotel.
From CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Treaty 6 Territory, this is the 2015 National Radio Homelessness Marathon. I'm Rylan Kafara.
And I'm Daniel Johnson. According to Homeward Trust Edmonton, Indigenous people are 9 times more likely than the overall population to be homeless in Edmonton. Indigenous people continue to make up 46% of people counted in the 2014 homeless count, while accounting for roughly 5% of the city's total population. It is important to state here that this is not an issue of overrepresentation. This term, overrepresentation, implies that there is somehow an acceptable level of Indigenous representation in statistics on homelessness. Indigenous people are disproportionately represented in the Edmonton homeless count. I also contend that Indigenous people who are quote-unquote homeless have been displaced and removed from their homelands as a result of settler colonialism. Indigenous people are labeled as homeless. In fact, they are at home, displaced by settlers in their own territories. The proportion of women who are homeless is increasing. Women make up 27% of those counted in the homeless count, but account for 40% of those who are provisionally housed. That is, women who are staying in a motel or couch surfing. Anecdotally, I have heard that women will choose precarious housing situations, couch surfing, staying with an abusive partner, sleeping rough, or walking the streets, rather than staying on a mat in a shelter. It would appear that the statistics on women and homelessness do not accurately reflect reality. There are women who are couch surfing and not accessing service agencies that are surely not counted.
My name is Dr. Michael McDonald. I'm an assistant professor of music at McEwen University and an adjunct professor in popular music at the University of Alberta. I'm active as a musicologist or an ethnomusicologist, but over the last number of years, I've been increasingly moving towards education research, and particularly one area of education research called critical pedagogy, which is built on the work of Paulo Freire, an activist educator from Brazil who wrote an incredibly important book called Pedagogy of the Oppressed. And from his work, founded an education movement called critical pedagogy, which recognizes the political context of education and recognizes that education is the process by which we reproduce our society. And we recognize that in the process of reproduction, we get to take some action and figure out what kind of society we want to have and get people, get students connected to looking around and seeing what's happening in the world and trying to sort it out for themselves.
From that context, we asked Dr. McDonald some questions about the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women in Edmonton and in Canada.
Listen, we've got to start with recognizing some uncomfortable truths. And capitalism, neoliberal colonial capitalism, is functioning perfectly well. Poverty is not an accident. Exclusion of Aboriginal women is not an accident. That's the way the system as it currently operates is designed to function. Missing and murdered women, like youth that are at risk and in high risk, like increasing poverty, like increasing existential crisis that's currently sweeping youth around North America. All of these things are absolutely expected outcomes of a system that's robbing from the future. No one looks at their parents' generation and says, my parents were way further ahead than I am right now, with way less education, and in many cases, way less financial outcome. Way less financial output. Way less time, and I've put in way more time, and I'm less well off. Okay. Most people, most undergraduate students in this in the system right now are going to look at their increasing debt loads, and they're going to talk to their parents, and it's just not going to be the same. Okay, what's happening is that we have a system that is systematically robbing from the future of the majority. As that happens, We have got to create a situation where students are looking at what their experiences are and realizing that the distinction between what is said and what the realities are don't line up. Once you start with that, then you can look at system-wide issues, and you can begin to see that system-wide issues, system-wide outcomes are a product of a system, not individual. Now, if you look at poverty or look at crime as an individual failure, as opposed to a social problem, then it's very easy, starting from the point of view of an individual issue, to then say that all of these women, these are individual cases, individual high-risk cases. The argument right now is a neoliberal argument. We're arguing with neoliberalism. And what's neoliberalism? Neoliberalism is the idea, a market-based idea, that everything can be boiled down to the individual. That it's ultimately the individual's responsibility to pull up your socks and solve the issues, the rugged individualism which we love in the West. Well, that rugged individualism leads us down the path to say, if you're poor, it's because you failed. If you're exploited, it's because you failed. If you find yourself at risk or in high risk, it's because you failed. There's something wrong with you. And not only is there something wrong with you because you did something wrong, but there's something wrong with you morally. You're probably not a good person. You failed both economically, and because you failed economically, you failed as a person somehow, and you should be cast aside. That logic lets people off the hook, lets the majority off the hook and say, well, individuals failed, there's nothing I can do about that. But we have to realize, and I think this realization is developing, we have to realize that a system-wide problem, and it's a system-wide problem for a system that's working perfectly well. See, that's the thing, right? We have to realize that the history of capitalism is the history of the exploitation of women, the history of genocide of indigenous people across North America, and a history of slavery. This system is built on the backs of system-wide extortion and theft. Point. If we start to realize that North American capitalism, our model of capitalism, is built on that kind of, built on those things, and none of them are, we need to argue anymore. The federal government has realized it. The federal government has apologized for it. So let's move forward. If we've apologized for those things as the government of Canada contributed and actively was involved in genocide, then why are we having a conversation that the continuation of that genocide on First Nations women and children is a topic of conversation? Why do we even need to have this argument? This is the continuation of a system that is still functioning perfectly well. We apologized for the system that functioned perfectly well, but we didn't change anything. An apology doesn't change the function of the system. So why are we imagining now that this system-wide problem is not the continuation of the thing that we apologized for already? I'm lost. This is the part of rhetoric that we need to begin to see through. We can't, on the one hand, have lived through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and then on the other side of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, not look at the glaring evidence of the system continuing to function in its murderous capacity without taking that on.
Once again at the Women's Emergency Accommodation Center, I talked to Jojo, who made several important connections between the foster care system, the missing and murdered Indigenous women, and the overall surround of violence facing women in the inner city.
I was taken away in 1968 from my natural biological mother taken away and put into a foster home. And with my sister and my brother, I'm native, by the way, but put into a foster home. And my sister and I, we were sexually abused throughout the years. And then by the time I was 9 and my sister was 10 years old, I heard my sister scream like crazy when she was 10 years old. Like she was being murdered or something, and I ran upstairs. And I opened the door, and here's my foster brother trying to sodomize her. And he told me to get the hell out, or I'm next. And then I ran out, and I said, enough is enough. You know, he kept threatening us that if we told that he was gonna hurt us really bad. So when I was 9 years old, I told Mom. And then Mom told us to keep our mouth shut or else she's gonna hurt us too. Like, badly hurt us, threaten us and stuff. So after that, I just became a rebel at school. I just didn't give a darn type thing. And I just did badly at school. I didn't care whether I did homework or anything. So after that, I raised my kids on my own. I stayed home. My husband did 2 jobs. Didn't even see Dad. Led to divorce and everything. But I raised my kids on my own. And I was the only one out of my family that raised my kids on my own. The rest of my family, my sisters, they had some of my sisters, and they had their kids taken away by child services and stuff, and their kids also were abused and stuff. So I'm thinking from 1968 all the way up until present, you know, from 68 all the way up until present, our kids are being abused. Why is it taking the system so darn long? Why is it taking the system so darn long to figure this out? To have things figured out for us, for our kids to be safe. Why do moms and dads out there, like biological moms and dads, have to take tests to get their own kids back? And how come foster parents don't have to take tests in order to be foster parents? You know? Some questions have to be answered, and none of them are being answered. I mean, this is crazy. The government's supposed to be looking out for Aboriginal women, and they're covering up all these murders for Aboriginal women and stuff. Like I said, you know, government A is covering up B and C. There we go. That's all I gotta say. Figure it out from there.
Rylan recently interviewed a group of women who meet regularly at the Boyle McCauley Health Center in Edmonton's inner city to hear their thoughts on the issue of murdered and missing Indigenous women. As we will hear, these women have passionate views on the issue. And not surprisingly, they also talked about the strength that they have gained from one another.
It was quite the opportunity to get to interview this group of women. They're They're a group of incredibly diverse and resilient people that have been meeting for about the last 15 years, almost every Thursday evening, to learn together, to eat together, and to talk about different issues. So it was really interesting to be able to bring up the issue of murdered and missing Indigenous women with them and get their thoughts.
I don't think the government gives a flying damn about those women in any way, shape, or form.
Is it because they're Native, or just because, is that why?
I think that's why, and that's just wrong.
Totally.
It's going to be up to the women. You can't depend on the government, because they said the funding is finished. They I get very heated up about that.
Yeah.
Because they've never got any time for the children. The funding, they make sure they get all their funding for themselves, you know. But it's due to lack of interest It's going to be up to the women. The women, when they see, it used to be when women couldn't vote. It's up to the women to gather together and pursue that, and they got the voting, the women.
Yeah.
So this is going to be the same thing with the original families and the murders and everything, and they never investigate. They never have time to investigate, and these poor women, but suffer because they haven't a voice. They're just pushed from one place to the other, and it's going to be up to the women. I feel for them to correct all the wrongs that the abused children take. And they don't want to hear about any of that. You can't depend on the politicians, because they're only self-interest.
That's right.
And I read that it was greed. I didn't know that, but it was greed. They make sure that their pocket is full, but they couldn't. They can't stretch their time for the women and the children.
Well, I'm Native, and I don't know, I think a lot of the missing women have a lot to do with prejudice, and plus they come from dysfunctional families.
So they don't feel that they have a right to speak up?
No, I don't know about that, but I mean, this is what I think. When you come from a dysfunctional family, then a lot of them, they turn to maybe drugs and alcohol because they're lost and stuff. But not all Native women do that. But then maybe because of the prejudice, some of them get murdered and stuff simply because of the belief that that Native people are... Some people believe that Natives are less than them, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. That's what I think.
I heard about the huge amounts of Indigenous women getting murdered and missing going on for a number of years now. And I feel the police, they need more of a task force like the states and the FBI to look into this. I don't think they're developed enough in Canada. I think they could set up cameras along the highways or the roads where these murders are going on, and they can narrow down, you know, people driving the vehicles that go on before and after these murders. And they could go on to... you know, people, undercover policemen, you know, even though it's very dangerous, but there's huge numbers of people getting killed, and I did hear about it a few years back, and it hasn't changed, so they haven't caught the culprits. And I feel that Canada needs to advance a little further, like the states, as far as its policing.
I think it's up to the women. When they gather together in groups, they'll change the world.
Yeah,
they really will, and they'll get into more political positions, and therefore they will make changes. It's up to the women.
And it's also trying to break the patterns. How many people gets the people are hooked on drugs and alcohol and their self-esteem is down, but the pattern has to break. The prostitution, there we go. And like, I mean, there's a lot of laissez-faire attitudes towards, getting rid of somebody or somebody says something or whatever. There's a lot of hate in that area. But people have to take a stand, and, you know, generation thing. Well, no, I'm going to try to get clean. I'm going to try to clean up so I can show, you know, how many people, I mean, even though they don't grow with a lot of mentors and stuff, but
you're a leader.
But it's a thing that people have to take their own ownership. Yeah. It's an awful thing. It's awful, awful, all these people that are become disposable. But that's white, that's Native, it's black, it's all cultures. People have to start feeling better about themselves and doing things to help themselves so they don't end up, you know, in the street thing, whatever, like, I mean, to support the rotten habit of drugs and stuff. People have to start feeling better for themselves. I don't know.
But it's called PC.
But it's like groups like this, like me being Native when I was young. There was some things like this, like when I needed help and my family is dysfunctional and I have no one to go to. But nowadays, the younger women, they have places they can go for help. But some of them, like their self-esteem, like it's been crushed so bad, like they're so lost. Maybe they don't care. So they want to forget and drugs or alcohol. So yeah. Like, this is really a hard issue, you know, but it's from starting things like this, you know, to learn. It's I learned from it. All these women about myself, which I, you know, would have been better if I could have learned as a child, and because I was very shy. But I feel I have more self-esteem now. But it's from women like these who have helped me a lot to know myself better, you know. And, you know, like we got to start from the bottom and it'll take years to change. And like the residential schools broke the family units up. And it's the new Native organizations that are trying to give us, help us to learn more self-esteem. And it, like it starts somewhere, and a lot of people, you know, they're gone, like, and they never got the chance. But I have the chance, and maybe I can help, like, my family from what I learned. You know, and they see me change and try, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, and then somebody else will try, you know, because they see that you've accomplished it.
Because yeah. I met my husband when I was 14. I would have my first child. When I was 16, I was really shy. He was the boss. But, you know, I loved to read lots, and that's how I learned there was a different way of life, and I had dreams. And I wanted to be stronger, so I left when I turned 50. My youngest turned 18, you know, but I had to struggle, I had to look for help, and
yeah.
I came here, and this is where I found most of the help for myself.
Oh my God, I like that, I like to hear that.
Yeah, but it's a hard struggle, but, you know, like I...
But you're making it easier for the next person.
I don't know. Maybe helping them to see that things can be different, but in the long run, it's up to them to make their choice.
How much they want. Yeah, that's right.
And some of them are too far gone. Maybe they can't change it. Like, it's complicated. People, you know, everyone believes different. Like, it's hard. So, everything's a struggle. Like, when you want things to be better.
Yeah.
She's become a great role model for all of us.
Yeah.
Not just for your people, but for all of us.
Thank you.
A compliment to you.
Thank you.
Once again, we spoke to Gary Moustous, inner city cultural support worker, for his thoughts on the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women in Edmonton and the rest of Canada.
You know, the government, this has been going on for years now, and the government always says that no, don't need an inquiry. We need to direct dollars towards the resources. Well, where are the resources? Where are the resources that they're always talking about that they should put dollars towards preventing this, for taking preventive measures? And again, another year comes by, and again, people are demanding an inquiry. Again, their response is, well, we're going to put dollars in that into resources, education, and all this. Well, where is all this stuff that's been voiced out for the last, I'd say, you know, 6 years that I've been working for the nonprofit agency? And then even beyond that, all the women that have been murdered. But I see in my time here in the city, which is now going on 15 years, and even back home and all the other places, is that these people who are committing these crimes, I personally believe myself that they haven't only done this once. You know, it's a repetitive behavior. It's like a shark that has its first taste of blood. It's like a dog who's bitten for the first time. That first taste of blood is, you know, they have no control. And it's the same with human beings. It's, you know, it's not only once, and they know who to prey on. It's the most vulnerable people, the most, you know, oppressed people, the people that are out there who society doesn't really care about. And most times, you know, it is the girls that are working on the streets to be able to help, try to help themselves, or try to you know, they're out there, they're very vulnerable. And it's just a repetitive cycle. And they know if we target this group that, you know, it's already, the government has already pretty much said it's open season for Aboriginal women because of their reaction towards the all the murders that have happened. Like, really, so it really doesn't prevent. And then, you know, you have, I'll use this example. You have a dog who was stabbed to death by a person. And you have this police dog who's, and now they've come up with a law that tightens time for a person who does harm to a dog, a service dog, a police dog. Like, what's up with that? A dog has more respect than a human being, is the message that we're getting. And, you know, it's just ridiculous how things are. And when Aboriginal women continue to die, there's no one that steps in and says, well, we're going to heighten or we're going to look at this and see what we can do to say that if any murder is committed violently on an Aboriginal woman or any woman or any child or any person, the sentence should be severe and swift and very severe. A family shouldn't have to go through 5 years of sitting in a courtroom hearing this over and over and then over again. It should be swift and very, very aggressive. And the death, I'm sure, was very, very, of the ladies and the people, was very swift. But I feel there's no justice in what is happening with the Aboriginal woman in particular. And like I said, it's open season, and they're very vulnerable to the people who commit these crimes.
In April, Métis Child and Family Service Society and CARE Victim Services will be presenting a two-day conference called Shaping the Future Together, Honoring Our Missing and Murdered. This will be a gathering to honor and remember missing and murdered peoples. For information on this gathering that will be held in Edmonton this April, phone 780-509-3353. That's 780-509-3353. For more information on missing and murdered Indigenous women, visit the community-led database and website at www.itstartswithus-mmiw.com or Google Support for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Their Families.
So wrapping up our hour from Edmonton and CJSR 88.5 FM, we've covered a lot of ground, I think, in terms of a number of issues that are affecting people who live in the inner city here.
Yes, we've spoke to community members, cultural support workers, academics, and from that wide range of people, Daniel, I think that they all touch upon the engagement that the rest of the country needs to have with these issues. And that dealing with them is going to come from the grassroots, from the communities. It's certainly not going to be top down.
And definitely a point that all of our guests made is how many intersections there are, I think, between these issues. So in asking a resident at the Women's Emergency Accommodation Center about the murdered and missing Indigenous women, she also talked about the foster care system. She also talked about the violence that existed in her relationship. There's numerous examples, I think, from this hour that point to how you can't just isolate one of these issues, that it's part of the overall structure and system.
Certainly not. You know, dealing with these issues is going to take a holistic approach. Even the issues around gentrification ties into the other aspects of what we've been talking about on the show. And if you don't deal with each part of it, then nothing's going to be changed.
And probably to summarize what all of our guests have said during this hour is that really our work is just beginning, that there's so much awareness that needs to be raised and so much work on the ground that we all need to undertake.
And yes, and even though it's going to be a process, that as we work on it, things are only going to get better and better if we stay engaged and we care and we listen to other people's voices.
Right. And not to lose sight of the fact that this work is being done every day, all the time, by people who live and survive and thrive in inner city communities. You've been listening to the National Radio Homelessness Marathon from CJSR FM 88.5 in Edmonton, Alberta, Treaty 6 territory. If you would like to comment on anything you heard during this hour, you can send an email to news@cjsr.com. We'd like to thank everyone who participated in this hour of the National Homelessness Marathon, and thank you for listening. I'm Daniel Johnson.
And I'm Rylan Kafara. We'll leave you with Finding Ontario, the 60s scoop song from Phyllis Sinclair.
Took my seat on a greyhound. I'm so damn scared, I'm shaking inside, but I've gotta go. I'm tired of thinking, tired of wondering about the things that I don't know, and
Thank you to CJSR in Edmonton, last year's host of the 2014 Homelessness Radio Marathon. And we will move now to a segment contributed by Gennarji O'Sullivan of Vancouver Co-op Radio. Gennarji's 90-minute contribution explores intersections between residential schools, homelessness, violence against Indigenous women, and missing and murdered Indigenous women. During the final half hour of this segment, you'll hear True Contact, Resonating Reconciliation in Southern Alberta. It was produced by Lauren Crazy Bull at CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge, Alberta. To provide a little bit of context about her segment, I spoke to Gennarji and will let her explain what you will hear for the next hour and a half. The time in Ontario, where CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston is hosting this year's marathon, is about 4 o'clock in the morning.